Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this special edition of Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. My name is Batavi Levantombini. I am your host, and I am so happy to welcome to the show today Amy Rebecca Marsico. Amy Rebecca is a storyteller, a person who's involved in theater. We're going to find out all kinds of things. I'm excited to have her on the show because she brings a dimension into peace building and mediation, in a sense, that is not conventional in terms of the way that mediators ordinarily work. So she is one of our allies in the peace, in the field of conflict management, dispute resolution, and peace building. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Good. Okay, so I have to remember that we're using my phone. This technology is so interesting, and we're doing this by speakerphone, so I'm trying to decide where I'm supposed to put my head in order to make sure that we're hitting the mic right, that it's right there. So there we are. Good. Amy, I have to say I'm really grateful that you're here because I love introducing people to diverse ways of approaching conflict management, dispute resolution, and peace building. And so your path is a little bit different than a lot of people out there who are practicing mediators, and I'd love to talk about that. But we also love to talk about people's stories and how they came to do what they're doing and what fuels their passion for what they're doing. So tell me a bit about what you're doing, and then we'll get into your story.
Well, I consider myself a conflict and peacebuilding practitioner. I did my master's at the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding, which is at Eastern Mennonite University. And it was just a wonderful introduction to the field of peacebuilding and the field of conflict transformation. And with conflict transformation, the university, my teachings really look at it as how you see conflict, how you interact with conflict, that conflict is something dynamic and changing, and that when you're addressing a conflict, you're not just looking at that particular issue. You're looking at all of the context, that the underlying structures that have led to that conflict. And it's really, I think that it's really seen as a catalyst for growth, that a lot of times when I go into a room and I do a little bit of teaching and I talk to people and I say, so what do you think about conflict? And most people think of conflict as something to be avoided or something to be afraid of, something that they don't want anything to do with. And so my background really looks at conflict as something to be, something to sort of explore, as a catalyst for growth, as a possibility for deepening a relationship or changing an unjust structure. So that's a little bit about my background in terms of the field of conflict and peacebuilding.
And you're principally working in New York?
Yes, I am. I'm principally working in New York right now. I work with youth. I do conflict work with youth where I talk about conflict, what is conflict, how does it make us feel, and then we sort of look at conflict as it's neither inherently good or neither inherently bad, and we start looking at for example, conflict, violent conflict is something that is obviously something bad, but a conflict that might have be positive, something that's needed for social change would be, for example, the civil rights movement, the fall of the Berlin Wall. We sort of look at some historical examples of when conflict can be seen as something constructive, something that's needed to move us further as a society. So I do that with youth, and there's a whole theater element as well.
Well, we'll get into that part of things. The theater element is what's really exciting to me, but and speaking of theater, it is the way that you kind of entered into this world. You work in New York City now, but you didn't grow up here, did you?
No, I grew up in Ohio, and I always dreamed of going to the big city. I knew from the time I was a small child I did not want to stay in Ohio, that I wanted to explore the world. And I was curious about people. I was curious about their stories. And I wanted to meet and mix with as many different kinds of people and cultures as possible.
Where did that come from? Were you reading books? Or
I mean,
family background?
I did have a very overactive imagination. And I was a book reader. I mean, I started reading at a very young age and read all kinds of different books, and so I think that a lot of it probably did come from reading. I've read a lot of books about children in England, children sort of growing up during World War II in England, and so I sort of started probably learning about the world a little bit from starting to read. And then as I got older, I just to just grow this desire in me to want to go and travel and see the world and also move to a much bigger city. I was living in a very small town.
So I understand that. I grew up in a small town, too. I had neighbors who had chickens. So, you know, and there's some things about that that can be lovely. You know, being in a community where, you know, one knows the rules and one knows the culture, and even in terms of people, you have enough contact with people that you are recognizable to everyone. You know, there's a certain level of anonymity that can happen here in New York City that's different. How did you experience that yourself growing up in a small town?
I mean, I had a very small world. You know, I actually didn't really feel like I fit in a lot growing up. I did do theater. I acted in some plays, some community theater plays, and that was a great outlet for me.
Well, because it allows you to travel.
In the beginning,
I mean, you know, in the story.
In the story, yeah. I mean, in the beginning, I didn't really feel like I had the same. I didn't have the same hobbies or the same preferences or the same likes as the other young people in my school, and I really felt like I didn't fit in. So theater became an outlet for me, and it was a great way, as you said, to explore different perspectives, different stories, different characters. And then after that, I knew I wanted to pursue. I sort of had two interests. One was sort of humanitarian, political, international work. And then the other was I really had a love for theater. And so when I went off to do my undergrad, I did a degree in theater. And then my senior year, I had the opportunity to go to New York. I was 21 years old, and I moved to New York City, and my parents were terrified.
Oh, my gosh.
Here we are. You know, I'm from Ohio, and I'm moving to New York City for the first time.
Yeah, by yourself.
By myself, and I actually...
Did you know anybody here?
I didn't really. I mean, I had the internship set up before I came.
Okay.
So I had some structure, but I had to find my own place to live, so I scoured the Village Voice ads, or back then it was Village Voice ads, and I scoured them to find out... you know, to find a cheap place. I was a college student. I didn't have any money. And I ended up renting someone's living room. So I slept in the living room, and they put a screen up. This woman turned out to be, unfortunately, she was schizophrenic. And so it was a very stressful living situation. But also just an incredible New York story.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I walked into her bedroom one day, and there was in lipstick written on the mirror, Francis Lopez. So, I mean, she lived in this very vivid fantasy world, and it was not easy living with her. And we had people coming into the apartment. We had a cab driver that used to come in the middle of the night and bring her coffee. We had different neighbors that would come in, and she did have a relative die, and then her whole family moved in with us for a while. So then there was a little lovely Japanese girl who was learning how to make pastries. And didn't speak a word of English, and she lived in the bedroom, which was a little bit more expensive than the living room, which is why I was sitting in the living room. But in order to sort of survive, because it was a little bit difficult, I took a job as a cigarette girl. And so I would work during the day at the internship, and then like three times a week I would work at those nightclubs in New York City selling cigarettes till 5 in the morning.
Wait, they still did that?
Well, this was a long time ago.
It couldn't have been that long.
It was a while. It was before the smoking.
We're not gonna go into exactly how long it was, but I think you and I have similar experiences about people not thinking we're as old as we are.
Yeah. So, mercy. You know, I'm probably dating myself a little, but it's part of my story because I was so determined to survive and make it in New York. And I remember I called my mother once and I said, I really am afraid to be in this apartment with Frances. She'd get on the phone and she'd start. She sometimes say some negative things about me. She was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother said, well, you chose to live in New York City. This is the path you chose. And I thought, well, what's that?
Mom said, you made your bed.
I better sleep in it. So I was on my own, basically.
Wow.
And I mean, it was from a place of love.
Sure,
but
sure.
There wasn't a lot they could do for me, you know.
Yeah. So you were not going to pack up and go home.
Oh, no. So I just found ways to not be at the apartment very much.
Mm.
And it was for just 6 months.
Right.
It was
doable. Yeah. But in New York City, you can do that because, as I said, you know, I did say that there's a level to which you can achieve a certain level of anonymity. But then, on the other hand, you can definitely find yourself forming a family and so forth. I lived in a different place from where I'm living now, and I was there for about 3 years, and I didn't realize that people were paying attention until, you know, there was a gentleman in particular. probably in his 70s, and he'd wave to me every morning when I was walking to the subway to go to work, and again in the evening when I was coming back home, every day, you know, during the work days. And then I went on vacation for about 10 days, and
he
I came back.
Worried about you.
Yeah. I walked past him, he's like, where have you been? I was like, oh, I was so touched. But, you know, I can't think people are paying attention to them all of a sudden, you know. And it was. It was the most heartwarming thing. In the city this size, you will form these families, this little collective, you know, in your neighborhood.
True.
Yeah.
So much fun. I love that story.
Isn't it awesome?
It's awesome.
Yeah. So you stuck it out for the 6 months, and then what happened?
And then I had to finish my last semester of school. So I went back for just 3 or 4 months, and then as soon as I finished, literally a few days after I graduated, I moved to New York City.
But by this time, you'd learned how to find apartments, and you were
I mean, Francis would have loved for me to come back, but it was not a good situation for me. It was really hard because she was crazy, and she had these fantasies about people being at the door, and then this guy that she had been with who had died. But anyway, so it had been difficult, but I was determined to just sort of regroup and have a better living situation, which I did. I found, a sublet. And my internship had led to an apprenticeship at the Hal Prince office. So I was working for the director, Hal Prince, for 6 months.
What is that?
In New York.
Hal Prince?
Hal Prince. He's a Broadway
director. Hal Prince. Oh, okay.
So I was just working in his office for the first 6 months, which was great. And that all came about because of the internship. And I thought at the time that New York was just a magical place for somebody young and excited and just wanting to do something, because it seemed like everyone I met, there could be different new opportunities that came out of that. So I never felt like I wasn't going to find my way, because people were so good to me, and I felt like if I just worked hard, I would be able to do this.
Right. Okay, so you come back, you have this internship, and then somehow there's this lead-in to, you know, working in, conflict resolution, peace building and that sort of thing. And I don't know if it's too fast to jump forward to England, but how did that happen?
So I was only in New York for 6 months. And as I told you, I really wanted to travel and see the world. And because I was a recent college graduate, I was sort of accepted, or I sort of fit into parameters of this particular program that allowed Americans to work legally in England, but I had to go within a certain amount of time. And so, you know, a lot of people said to me, oh, you're taking such a risk, you're leaving New York, you've spent all this time building relationships and fostering growth, and here you are, you're turning around and you're just leaving everything behind. But I just felt like I had to take this opportunity to see the world, at least a little bit of the world, and to go outside of the U.S. So I moved to London. And I
now again another big city in a different country.
Different country,
totally different. Well, you know, New York is its own culture. I was going to say totally different culture, but hey, if you've been to New York and survived it, you're okay.
Right. exactly. And so, you know, I feel like I was definitely a little bit better versed to deal with London, because I had the experience of New York behind me, and especially that crazy living situation. So I was ready.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was there, I ended up getting work in the theater, and it was wonderful. I worked for a general management company, and they were very good to me, and it was a wonderful experience. But while I was there, the Bosnian War was going on, and I just was so moved by the fact that this war was happening not far from where I lived, that it was happening on European soil. And the way it had been portrayed in the media in the U.S., sort of, you know, very simplified, sort of painted as, oh, we'll have these ancient ethnic hatreds towards each other, that nobody has ever gotten along. When I started reading, especially about Sarajevo was a multi-ethnic city.
The Olympics had been hosted there.
20 to 25% of the marriages were mixed.
Mm-hmm.
People lived not neighborhood by neighborhood, but within an apartment building, you would have floors mixed together of all kinds of different people living there. There would be a church and a mosque, a synagogue, all within the same sort of the same area. And so I knew that there was more to that story. And the way that I think the media was really simplifying it, and especially in the U.S., living in the U.S., I could sort of look at the war on TV or sort of glance at a newspaper article, and I didn't feel as affected by it. And I really think it was the experience of living in a foreign country, of, and especially London, which is, you know, such a cosmopolitan country. You have, so I lived in a house with people from South Africa, from New Zealand, from Spain, from Chile, from Australia. So I lived in this house with a lot of different types of people, people from different places. And then I was always hearing different accents on the street. I was meeting people from India, from Hong Kong, from Pakistan. So there were just a huge mix of people. And so I think that was part of it, that I suddenly felt, I didn't feel, I mean, I never would have said, oh, I feel isolated living in the U.S. But then once I was in Europe, I felt like I was more a part of the world. And I guess that's the best way I can articulate it. I really felt like I was part of this world community in a way that I hadn't previously. And I think certainly the experience of being in a European country and having a war on European soil really affected me. And for the first time, I was seeing convoys packed and loaded with supplies, ready to move out to really besieged towns. I mean, I was glued to the news. I was watching the news. And then there were some Croatian girls that were refugees that actually moved into an apartment building just down the street from where I was living. So I remember going to the theater one night, and I was sort of waiting in line to use the restroom, and I started talking to the girl behind me. And she said that she was a student, and when I asked her where she was from, she said, "I'm from Sarajevo." And I said, and I was so just profoundly moved by meeting somebody from Sarajevo, having read about the fact that it was under siege, that people were shelled and bombed, and that there was little food, and that it was very hard. And I said to her, "Well, how is your family?" And she said, "I don't know. I can't get to them." So it really, for me, affected me. It really brought the war home, and it was a very powerful experience. So after I returned home, London. I was in London for a year and a half. I was only supposed to be there for, I think, a certain amount of time, but I talked my company into applying for a work permit for me so I could stay. And actually, it probably would have stayed even longer, but my good fortune came to an end, and they finally denied me. And I had to go back.
Go home!
And so I spent like 2 months in Ohio just really depressed that I was no longer in London. And then I got a call from the Halprin's office saying, "Can you fill in for a leave of absence?"
Yeah.
So I moved my, it was such a blessing. I moved myself back to New York City, and I just remember really wanting to do something about Bosnia. And I would talk to people about Bosnia, and I was so passionate about it. And most people, again, were like me before I went to Europe. They had sort of seen something about it, but felt very separate from it, and I felt so connected to that war. So I remember calling different aid organizations and saying, "Please take me. I'm willing to volunteer," and nobody wanted to take an unskilled volunteer.
Which is an interesting concept, right? How are you going to get skills if you can't?
Exactly. And it's really a catch-22, and I still haven't quite figured that out. But for whatever reason, despite my passion and my assertiveness in terms of phoning these different organizations and asking to be accepted, nobody would take me. And then finally, I wrote a letter to the International Rescue Committee, and it was the New York Refugee and Resettlement Division of the International Refugee Committee, and their whole job is really to resettle refugees, that when they're coming into New York, that they have a support system in place, help them get settled, find apartments, furniture, employment, adjust to life in the U.S., learn English.
Discover that there's an east side and the west side to New York City. Do you remember Serena L?
Oh, yes.
It took me a while.
Oh, yeah, with the numbers.
Well, yeah, so, you know, I lived up far enough in the Bronx that it was where the 2 and the 5 met. And I didn't realize that it mattered which train you got on.
Oh, I've done that before.
Ah, that's great.
Yeah, it took me a really long time, actually, to master the train. I didn't understand. In the beginning, nobody, like, unless you know that there's an express train and a local,
right,
you might make a mistake and just get on the wrong train.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's
which
exactly.
And we ended up, you know, walking from the east side to the west side on a number of occasions when we discovered we were on the wrong side of 120.
Well, I have done that before, so you are not alone.
Right. Well, but what's great is that for refugees coming in, they don't necessarily have to go through that. You have somebody who's here who's going to help show you the ropes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I had written this letter and talked about my interest in Bosnia, and they actually called me in and said I could start volunteering for them. And I was so happy. I would go in every Tuesday. Mm. And my job actually wasn't exactly helping refugees who were coming in get settled. My job was to help people who had relatives in refugee camps, because at the time there was something called the Family Reunification Program, and these were Sierra Leonean and Liberian families whose relatives had been sort of caught up in the civil wars in those countries and had fled out of terror to refugee camps. Under the family reunification program, they were eligible to have their families come and join them in the United States. It's a long, complicated, arduous process. So my job was to meet with these families, really, and I would listen to their stories, really got a sense of what, because they had talked to their relatives in the camps, and so the trauma was really fresh. I mean, even though they themselves hadn't gone through it, they were really traumatized by what their families
were
having gone through.
Well, it can be worse, because, you know, the imagination can quadruple the actual intensity of what's going on, especially when it's a loved one and you're feeling helpless and there's nothing that you can really do about it.
So I would listen to their stories, and then I would sort of advise them on, okay, this is what we should do at CRRC. Mm-hmm. And then I would take that. I had to fill out an affidavit of relationship, very long, complicated form, because the U.S. government needed to ascertain that there was an actual link, a family link. So we had to list, you know, their address, their all of their particulars, how many children the parents have had, brothers, sisters, everyone that would be coming over.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite long, but once that was done, I would get it notarized by our lawyer, and then that would be sent off to an office, probably UNHCR, the refugee agency of the UN, to start, they would do the interviews, just sort of verify all the data, and then if things worked out, relatives would eventually be able to come to the U.S.
Wow.
It's a long process. I've learned so much just about, about the experience of being a refugee, at least through the eyes of family.
So were you able to witness any reunion?
Actually, I didn't personally, but the first day that I was there, my supervisor, who was this wonderful woman who had actually escaped Vietnam and with her family and working for an American consulate there, and then she had dedicated her life to helping refugees get resettled the way she had been.
Mm-hmm.
She sort of said to me, I want you to witness this. She brought me into a room, and there was a young man there, Burundi. And 5 years previous, he had been in the U.S. on a business trip. The war broke out in Burundi, and he did not return home. And at that time, his wife, his children, living in Burundi, and he had thought he was just going for, you know, a week or 2 weeks for this business in New York City. His wife was pregnant, and because of the war, he was not able to return home. It was too dangerous for him. He was not. He had spent years trying to figure out how to get his stuff to the U.S. In this meeting, my boss, a woman that I really respected and admired, told him for the first time, "Your family is coming, and this is the day, and this is all the information.
Oh.
Your family is coming to meet you."
Wow.
And it was one of the most powerful experiences I've ever had because I thought about it. You know, this. He left his wife, she was pregnant, now he would have a five-year-old child that he had never met. And just...
And that they made it.
That
they made it, because the brutality in that situation, you know, I know people, particularly from Rwanda, I also know a couple of people from Burundi, but especially from Rwanda, who lost everyone. I think they have, like, one remaining relative. You know, so that he was able to be reunited with his wife and his kids, anyway. Amazing.
It's amazing. I mean, that story just, again, profoundly shaped me.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, I've never, on a personal level, I've never had that kind of trauma or be tested in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it must take such strength of character. That's what I'm really interested in, how people survive these unimaginable circumstances. I mean, to be stuck in a foreign country where, you know, I'm sure he's language a little bit, but as he was doing business in English, but still, foreign country, no family here, for 5 years on his own. I just imagine it, and that's what's interesting, is how people thrive and survive and have resilience, despite these just unimaginable circumstances.
So you've managed to then take these experiences that you're so passionate about and marry them with your work in theater and so forth, and I'm interested in how that developed. But first, let me make sure, you know, I want to hear more of your stories about working with the IRC and how that developed. You're working with populations that are from Liberia, Burundi. Did you ever get to work with people from Serbia?
You know, it was so amazing. Half of the, this is such a testament to the human spirit, half the people that worked in the office were Croatian or Bosnian. So they were resettling. At the time, they were resettling a lot of Bosnians, and they had hired people who were from that country to work with them and to sort of caseworkers who could speak Bosnian. And the man that actually sort of took me on as a volunteer, he had spent significant time in Croatia and spoke fluently, and he was American. But it was just a wonderful atmosphere to be around, and I did, you know, I didn't actually get to work with anybody from Bosnia, but I really felt good about the part that I was playing with filling out these affidavit of relationships, these sort of tedious, long, complex documents.
Yeah.
And then while I was there, the Kosovo crisis happened, and, you know, we were sort of flooded with some people, because there was such a mass crisis.
Yeah.
So the whole experience was really sort of, I see it as a continuation of what I was interested in when I was in London.
Now, you did say earlier on that your college, your degree is from the
Eastern Mennonite University.
Right, and your focus was on conflict or peace, on peace building?
Yeah, the degree is conflict transformation.
Okay, exactly.
And I was very lucky because I went to school with people all over the world. Yeah. I was actually, as an American, I was in the minority. Which I was really excited about. There were students that were on Fulbright scholarships to study peace, and they were sent to my university. So the first semester, I was in school from Burma, from India, from Nepal, from Liberia, so from Kenya. So I really got to meet, again, really getting to meet different people, and I think it was so important studying conflict, studying international matters, sort of see how America is seen through the eyes of other people, and that's what was so rich about those classes.
What did you learn?
Oh, I learned so much. Just how the U.S. is sometimes viewed, and I did a little bit of research on it. You know, I had this friend named Lam, and being sort of, I consider myself in New York in a way, lived here for a while, even though
I more than 10 years.
Actually, I was out of New York for quite a while, but as an adult, I've lived here longer than I have any other place.
Oh, okay, then you count.
So I don't know. Anyway, having roots in New York, was really curious about how other people view September 11th and what was said. And I did have somebody say to me, "We're very sad that happened, but part of us said now they have a chance to taste." And so it was things like that, which is, of course, many people would have a hard time hearing that, but I wanted to hear it.
I desperately
wanted to understand where other people were coming from and how they thought. And some of our policies are very aggressive, very violent.
Yeah. I have to say that I also understand that, and I wish that as Americans we would be more open to understanding that, too, because, you know, you met this young woman online whose family's in Sarajevo. They're being shelled on a daily basis. They can't get food. We didn't have close to that. Now, the tragedy, we have people who have lost family members, and it is devastating, whether it's one person, whether it's 2,000 people, it is devastating. However, really, you know, I don't like to engage in doing a hierarchy of suffering.
No, not at all.
It's not about that. But there is a certain reality to the fact that I personally didn't have to worry about where am I going to get my next meal on September 12th.
And I think exactly. And I think what I took away from the experience, and of course there were many other things too, like things to learn about the Rwandan genocide from someone who had actually been there in Rwanda and was real Rwandan, things like that. But I think what I took away from it is that other people feel that they have to love and happen
all the time.
And some of it is because of, again, U.S. policy.
Sure.
So, I had read about, you know, I wasn't naive. I was pretty well-versed in U.S. policy, and I had read quite a bit before I started school. But there's something so human about hearing it, somebody's experience. It transcends anything that you would read in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how I felt about my experience in London and meeting people from Bosnia and Croatia who had experienced war.
Right.
You can read about it, but there's still a distance. You meet somebody, and you have this very human exchange. You understand on a completely different level.
So now what I'm curious about is you have this academic background, this theoretical background, and so you have these experiences in England, and you come back to the United States, and you're working for the IRC. And I'm curious about...
You're volunteering
with the IRC. So I'm curious about how you experience your work with the IRC in the context of this academic theoretical background.
Well, I did the IRC before I went to school.
Ah, okay.
So I didn't go to school until well after the IRC.
Okay.
But I definitely think having the IRC background helped me in terms of testing my theories when I was in the classroom. And it just, again, sort of broadened me in terms of the experience. And I definitely think, you know, there was a real mix of people in my program. There were some people who worked in the U.S. who were really focused on peace building in the U.S. And I think because of the experiences that I've had, both in London and at the IRC, I was really interested in how do we do peace building in the rest of the world? And how does the rest of the world view peace building? And I think that's where I really benefited from being able to all over and really learning from their experiences.
So after you graduated from college, what was next for you?
Well, I was continuing to work in the theater, but then I did still try to cultivate opportunities where I could work with youth, teach about conflict. As I said, I think one of my passions is really how do we reframe conflict? Because I think that many young people see as something to be avoided or something negative, something that you don't want to deal with. And even as adults, I can do that too. And so what I've tried to do is really use theater to teach about conflict. And I like to use Auguste Boal's image theater, which is where you create still picture or still sculpture with body of particular conflict or a trauma or an oppression. And so when I teach about conflict and I say, you know, what do you think of conflict? How does it make you feel? And then we talk about constructive conflict, destructive conflict. Then I say, okay, what are the conflicts in your community? And I say, what are the conflicts in your community? Everyone really wants to generate a list because now we're getting to the good part. We're actually making it personal and working on problem solving in the community. And so when I worked with a group years ago, they came up with a pretty heavy theme, teenage pregnancy, racism, abandonment, violence, gun violence, gang violence. And so from that, we created sculptures about topics. And there's something about seeing this image of people creating this picture that's usually at the crux of the conflict. There's something really powerful about that, and there's a nonverbal element. So it provides a space for people to really open up and talk about what they see in that image and what that image says to them and what are the themes and the meanings. And from that, you can kind of move to another level, which is, okay, so we've looked at this image. How do we, in real life, how can we make this real to ideal? How can we take a real image and work on it?
Right. And so, you know, because we are not broadcasting visually, and I've seen this, and it was such a marvelous thing, and that's why I just had to have you on the show. I wanted to do a little bit more of a more detailed kind of description of how this works. I know that if you're working with a group, for example, you may ask your volunteers, and they'll come to the front of the room, and then what do you do next?
And usually there is one person who is considered the sculptor.
Okay.
And the sculptor is somebody who is going to use the human body, several people, to create a picture of what he or she is seeing in her mind that is symbolizing the conflict. And so this one person comes forward and working silently, she moves people into relationship with one another. So, for example, the example that I did that you saw was of a young woman clearly troubled and being rejected by her parents, by what could be a young man of about her age, perhaps a boyfriend. And so we show this image, and then we say to the rest of the room, what do you see in the image? And so right away, people get the relationship. They get that the parents are angry or upset or rejecting the daughter, and then that she's reaching out as if to try to have a conversation with the young man in the image, and he is putting up his hand and turning his face, we see that he doesn't want anything to do with me. And then the next part of it, I'll say, okay, so this is an example of your conflict. What would we do visually to make this an ideal picture? And so the young woman that I was working with was a sculptor and changed the image so that she was being embraced by the family and the young man. So we went from theme of rejection to a theme of love and acceptance.
Mm.
And so then I say, okay, let's go back to the drawing board. We've seen the real, we've seen the ideal. What are the steps that we take to get there? And I found, I think with young people, it's very empowering when they're asked to problem solve in their life and sort of develop their own agency. And they came up with some wonderful ideas. Mm-hmm. And it was also a chance for them to talk about things that I don't think that they have the chance to talk about, because there aren't spaces in the structure of the way we live our lives, whether it be institutions like religious institutions or education institutions. They had been taught they had sex ed classes, but nobody had ever really talked to them about what it means to have a relationship, the difference between sex and love. So this was a chance for them in a safe space to have this dialogue, and that's what the nonverbal element allowed for.
We're really great about talking about the biology of it all.
Exactly.
But the relationship of it all. And I do have to say that if there's anything that I really took away from seeing the presentation that you did, you know, when they say that a picture is worth a thousand words, it was huge, because for each person, you know, it gave them an opportunity to overlay their own experiences, you know, put into this tableau sort of,
yeah.
Right? Meaning, you know, put meaning onto it. And so there's a certain level of empowerment that happens in that moment, especially for the sculptor. You're talking about this young woman getting to then create an ideal and actually move people around and see it.
Yeah.
You know, it's really powerful.
It's also powerful when other people in the room verbalize what she's been thinking and feeling.
Yes, yes.
And that's where I think it's so empowering for a young woman to have that experience.
Yeah.
She hears what other people are saying, and it matches what is in her heart.
Right. So, you know, she's getting this affirmation as well.
Exactly. And I think as human beings, especially in conflict, you know, we're meaning-making creatures.
Mm.
We make meaning. We want, and different, and where we get into conflict, but different people assign different meanings to the same issue.
Right.
And so it is interesting to sort of come together and dissect our different meanings,
mm-hmm.
and look at what we have as commonalities and look at what we need to do to go deeper.
Right. Now, there was another aspect to the presentation that you did, which has to do with reading stories as scripts, having people take on the characters of real people, actually. So tell me more about that.
Yeah, I am a huge fan of documentary theater. Mm-hmm. And documentary theater is when you might go into a community and you interview people about a particular problem or a conflict, or it could be anything, a story, and then you document, you transcribe it. You have these raw interviews. And then what I like to do is I take the interviews and I craft them into a piece, a theater piece. And the particular piece that I've been working on lately is this piece on Arab Americans. Because after 9/11, especially after my experience of being in school and seeing how other people in the world viewed 9/11, and being from New York and having my own experiences, I was really interested in what it must be like to be Arab in America, particularly after 9/11. And I was particularly interested in what are the identity needs. So if you are from a country in the Middle East that might have some relationship to September 11th, what does that mean for your identity as an American? Because you're also an American citizen. And how do you hold those two realities, those two identities? And so I was very privileged. I had the opportunity to go into Dearborn, Michigan, which has the largest population of Arab Americans in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And people were very loving and sort of let me into their lives, and I was able to interview quite a few people, not just about 9/11, but just about where they came from, what their identities were like, how they see the world, how they fit into the world. And from that, I was able to craft a piece, and I've been using it since March. I've been guest teaching at John Jay College. And it's been so powerful for me, because a lot of the young people that read these words people that I interviewed have found ways to really relate to their story, even if they have completely different backgrounds, that they found commonalities.
But it's an amazing thing to have to speak the words, you know, of somebody else, even if it's somebody who's rather different from yourself or different from, or has a very different perspective, viewpoint of things. It reminds me, actually, of what happened with Occupy Wall Street and the human mic.
Oh, it's a very similar
awesome?
Thing. Yes.
Yes. I thought that it was the best thing. You know, in the beginning, you look at the reason for the people's mics, right? It was because the city has a law or an ordinance or something that says that you cannot have amplification without a permit. And so if you don't have a permit to have microphones and so forth, you know, you can't have speakers and that sort of thing. So in order to have people heard over 300-400 people, they had this system where a speaker would speak, and then the first 10 people would shout it, and then the next 20 people would shout it, and so forth, so that the word would go back. And a couple of things that were amazing about that. One was the accuracy. You know, that it really was very accurate. It was not like playing telephone. It was quite accurate. But the other thing was that even if you utterly disagreed with what the speaker was saying, you had to say their words. And it has an interesting psychological impact.
Well, there must be a higher level of engagement when you're actually
absolutely
involved in that way.
Yes.
You're not just passive. You're not just listening. You're actually acting.
Yes.
You're repeating.
Absolutely, yes. So it reminds me in a sense of this, where you have people, you know, sitting or however you have them arranged in the room, and you hand out these scripts. And they are reading the words of people who, you know, for some, this is the enemy. Right, and so now they're reading the stories of these people who have been cast as the enemy, but now you are embodying that character. And who really is that? And what kind of level of knowing do you get to by being involved in that particular activity?
Well, and that's just it. I think that's the beauty of documentary theater, that it does have this possibility of showing us all of the contradictions and the complexities of the human experience. Because people are neither all black or all white. Everybody is a mix. And I think especially living in New York, there probably still are people that are very fearful of Arab American. And I just wanted people to see them as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Love, like, just like right. My preference.
Well, you know, another amazing thing I think about the piece that you've done is the way that you weave stories together. So it isn't as though we're just sitting there and listening to one person as a monologue, but you've taken these interviews and transcribed them, as you said, but then have woven them together in a way that there are perhaps parallels, right?
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting things for me when I sat with all the interviews, and it took me a very long time to transcribe everything.
Oh, yeah, you did.
but after the months and months and months of taking and transcribing,
yes.
Sit there and read them, I would just highlight every time I saw commonality.
Yeah.
And I thought it was so interesting because I saw repeated themes. And when I saw repeated themes, I knew that was what I needed to bring out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is, it's an amazing way of getting to that. I mean, we say this, you know, that ultimately underneath all of it all, we are the same. But to have it so vividly expressed is a really special thing. So what are your plans for it?
Now, I have to finish it because I've not completely finished it. I've got a huge section done. But because it's something that I do on my free time, it hasn't been something that I can work on straight through.
Sure.
So I am going to finish it. And then I don't know. You know, I had always sort of, in my dream, I'd envisioned partnering with maybe an organization that was sort of promoting tolerance or looking at relationships between Arab Americans, sort of introducing Arab Americans to the U.S., sort of tolerance building or bridge building or peace building organizations. But I would love to see it have a life because, you know, the best part about documentary theater is that it's not just excited. The idea is that it's captivating enough in the ideal world that the audience wants to stay afterwards to have a dialogue about that. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing in this country to sit down and have a dialogue and for people to be able to use play as a way to respond, to react, be able to verbalize what they're feeling if they if they've learned anything different, if they saw something in the character that they could relate to, if there was something that surprised them. And I think having public dialogue is a great thing. And I guess in an ideal world, I would love to see it produced, and I would love to see there be a forum where people could come together and have a dialogue after the performance.
Well, I have to tell you the fit that I saw, because I know that it's just a fit that you presented at that point, was utterly captivating. I mean, I was totally sucked in and did want to talk. And the amazing thing is that, you know, I realized that the people who were sitting around the table had been given the script. You know, they're reading somebody else's words. But I wanted to come up to them afterwards and say, tell me more. You know, separating the fact that they're acting, they're taking on a character, from the fact of who they really are as people. And what was also amazing was that we did have a dialogue afterwards.
We did.
And people were able to share how their own stories in some ways mirrored or paralleled the things that they were reading in the script.
Yeah, there's a lot about identity in the piece and what it means to hold different identities. I'm always amazed because that every time I do this, it really strikes a chord with someone. We did it that day. I think that there was a woman who was a refugee herself and had lived in several different countries and had a son, and her son had grown up not sort of knowing which identity to ascribe to. And she was very connected to the piece because of that. And I think anytime we talk about identity, especially in the 21st century where borders are changing and you know, there's so much more with globalization, there's cultures are sort of morphing, I think it can be a really interesting question.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I'm thinking about this show, for example, is because it's online, literally it can be heard anywhere in the world that there is an internet connection. And there are people who listen from all over the world.
Oh.
So, you know, the idea that we can be, what's the word I'm looking for, that we can be so absorbed in a particular place and in being, you know, of a specific kind of people, we don't have that anymore. Some people might see it as a luxury. That's the word that was coming to my mind on the one hand. But then I was like, no, it's not about that. I enjoy not only meeting people from around the world, but also seeing where do I fit into that and what do I like from, you know, France, and what do I like from Kenya, and what do I like from Germany, you know, and being able to pick and choose from there, widening smorgasbord of stuff that one can be exposed to and also adopt, you know, as part of themselves and their own identities. Yeah.
It makes it so much more interesting. I am a huge music fan, and yes. There are Senegalese artists that I like.
Yes.
There's an artist from the Congo, from DRC, that I like.
Yes. Gangnam Style?
Yeah.
Yeah? Have you heard that one?
I think so.
Oh, my gosh, it's from Korea.
Maybe I haven't heard that one.
Okay, after we're done, I'm going to show it to you. It has gone wildly viral.
Oh, wow. But I love world music, so I'm always discovering a new artist.
Yes.
And I love all the different influences.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think traveling definitely had a huge impact on me.
Yeah. So you're working on this piece, and there's other stuff that you're doing.
Yeah.
What else is going on for you?
Right now, I've been consulting for a nonprofit called Interchange Works over the last year, and it's woman is remarkable. She runs this organization, and it works in Nicaragua.
Mm.
And so I got to go with her to Nicaragua for the first time, and we are working with a local university, the university students to develop a violence prevention program.
Mm.
And the idea is that they would, we have certain themes that we're working on, and they will generate stories and be acted out, and then those stories and those actors will travel to the rural areas of Nicaragua, put on a piece about violence prevention, domestic violence, anti-bullying, leadership, and the young university students that were chosen for this program, it fulfills one of their requirements, their social and community outreach, and it's also a wonderful way to sort of interact with areas of the country that don't always have access to theater, to music, to the arts. So I think that the young people that I'm working with are really excited about the possibility of doing this as their community service project. So we started our first, we did our first week of workshops that project, and there'll hopefully be a time where I go back so that I can finish the project. Yeah.
How exciting. And I know that when you finally see it performed, you know, this is a marvelous experience. What else are you doing here in New York?
I did a girls empowerment workshop on media literacy not too long ago, and that was really exciting because I think that the media impacts so much of for young girls, how we see ourselves, body image, how we see self-worth, value. And again, these are things that people don't always get to talk about. Young people don't always get to talk about, so I just outlined. And then I've been guest teaching at John Jay College over the last few months. That's pretty much where I am right now.
I'm looking forward to you coming and talking to my class.
Oh, yes. I'm really looking forward. I've just loved the time at John Jay. I've had a great time.
Yes. Well, it's an amazing thing to work in that particular situation or in that particular context. You know, John Jay is the College of, don't let me get this wrong, is it criminal justice?
Yeah.
Terrible. Oh, my gosh. I just started working there, so I'm still learning all the nomenclature. But it's an awesome opportunity to have, this influence, this opportunity to work with people whose lives are going to be involved in dealing with violence, dealing with conflict, and law enforcement. And so to have an opportunity to influence the way that they think about conflict before they're actually out there on the street, so that if they are in law enforcement, hopefully they'll remember back to that class that they took and make different choices about how they're going to address the conflict that they're dealing with than they might have had if they had not taken this class.
That's really important.
Yeah.
It's really important. But then they start to see people as human beings.
Yeah. Always. And you can try to see, people as human beings no matter what the situation is. I'm influenced by what I have been reading for this class and, preparing the lectures and so forth, and then actually your work and work with other people. It finally came to say, it's important for us to be able to see ourselves and our enemy. We've decided that somebody's your enemy because the idea of enemy in the first place. Actually, I'd like to ask you about that and about what your studies say about whether there is such a thing as enemy.
I mean, people do have very strong feelings about that, and there are some people who really do see other people as their enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of what the teaching that I've grown up with, the program that I did, a lot of emphasis is put on the victim-offender cycle, which in trauma, a lot of times, if you have been a victim, if someone has done harm to you, there are many stages of that cycle, of that life cycle, becoming a victim. But many times, you can kind of slip into being an offender.
Mm.
So it's this idea of the victim-offender cycle where someone hurts you, you sometimes hurt somebody else. When you understand that, you understand how people become victims and how victims then sort of manifest in a way of they become offenders, and you have a better understanding of maybe the root causes of why somebody chooses violence or chooses to hurt somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of thought put on trying to break the victim-offender cycle, so that you are in a place where you're able to forgive and let go of that anger, move beyond that. And then there's sort of the sweet spot, which is when you find resilience and you are able to overcome that trauma or that offense by finding strength in yourself to be resilient and to rise above it. And then there's something called post-traumatic growth, which is after you've moved beyond that, you do grow. You sometimes can become a different or more complex person because you've experienced trauma.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, in the beginning of that, there is that idea of the victim sometimes becoming the offender. And two things come to mind. One is, again, reinforcing that idea of seeing yourself in your enemy. right? Of course, assuming that you ascribe to the idea of an enemy and what all of that means. But then there is that other part allows, you know, you're talking about this cycle, learning what the cycle is all about, and the idea that anybody can be that person. As you were speaking, what came to my mind was the Milgram study. Okay, and where those studies came from, and for folks who might not be aware, after World War II, social scientists were looking at what happened, and particularly what happened with German people who were involved in military action and in killing and so forth. And they discovered that, you know, later on in the war, as they ran out of younger people to draft into the army, they had to start bringing in older and older people. And so you'd have people in their late 30s, early 40s who were being brought into the army who had, you know, terrible conflicts because several things happen when a person is younger than, let's say, 23. Certain parts of the brain haven't completely developed. Perhaps they haven't experienced certain things in life. So it's easier for them to take orders, easier for them to be molded into a particular ideology, and then to go out and actually be able to kill in support of that ideology. The older ones, you know, they've got this complex thought mechanism going on, and so they talk about being terribly conflicted about what they're doing, and so Milgram wanted to kind of study that in a more lab-like atmosphere. So he set up these studies where people were brought in and were told that they were actually electrocuting somebody else. Like, you swap right in one way or the other, and he wanted to see how far people would go. But these studies are actually infamous in the world of social sciences. They're the reasons why we have a human subjects review board. Because the people who were involved, who were inflicting the electric shocks, were so traumatized by what they were doing to the other people. Because you could hear screams, you know, these horrible screams, but yet they're taking orders, and Milgram wanted to see, bless you, Milgram wanted to see how far will people go taking orders before they'll say, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. And so it was amazing what he discovered about that, that people who would otherwise be considered really upright, upstanding citizens, they're not the typical thugs that you might imagine is out there committing violence, could be induced to engage in tremendous acts of violence, or what they thought were tremendous acts of violence. Yeah. So this is what I'm thinking about as you're talking about the victim-offender cycle and how important it is, the work that you're doing, that more people come to understand that, you know, being the offender, you know, being the violent person, is not a matter of genetics. You know, it's not a matter of nationality, that certain nationalities are more prone to this, that, or the other.
Right.
But it's about human conditions and, you know, where you happen to be in the circumstances that happen to be present in any particular moment.
You know, it's funny, there was just south of where I live in Brooklyn, there was a shooting a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. and the community, the neighborhood was just outraged because it was a young boy on a bus. He fired shots and killed a young 29-year-old woman standing next to her son.
Oh.
He was trying to kill, she was not the target, mm-hmm. he was trying to kill like somebody he was in conflict with to be a gang member.
On his bike?
On his bike, killed a 29-year-old mm-hmm. woman. And the community just wanted to lynch him. And obviously, he did something really terrible. But my immediate thought was, what happened in his past lead him to commit such a terrible
And to think of him doing it, you know, the thing that's striking for me, not to diminish the tragedy of this woman being killed in any way, but what does it say about him that he's doing this on his bike? For me, it means that getting away is not necessarily a primary, you know, thought for him. He's not going to get very far very fast on a bicycle. So it says something about how he values himself, right?
Yeah.
How he values his other life and what's going on that makes that so important to him that he's willing to risk the lives of all these other people and end up shooting the wrong person, tragically. It would have been tragic had he shot the person he was after. But, you know, there's a thought paradigm there that just seems so foreign to me.
Yeah.
Oh, if we have time.
Oh.
Oh, by the way, yes. So we get this lovely notice when it comes down toward the end of an hour that tells us we have now, you know, 0 seconds of airtime left. And so we've gone into recording mode. So we're going to be able to wrap up nicely.
Okay.
I should have warned you about that before.
I'm like, I better stop talking.
Oh, my gosh. It's over. We're going to get off. But, no, we have some time, and so we can wrap up nicely. But that's what's going on in my mind, is the psychology of it is really, something that's incredible to me.
Well, and, of course, I was thinking, you know, these young people who are in gangs and resort to violence,
yeah.
Is it because what are they missing? What are they not getting in their lives? Is it for identity reasons? Is it for self-esteem? Do they feel a sense of belonging in the gang that they're not getting from society? Because there's so much unemployment, and I do think perhaps maybe they haven't been able to find work. Maybe the gang is a way for them to have this sense of self-worth.
Well, and then also it may be just a matter of safety. You know, the neighborhood that I live in, you remarked on how nice it was when you were walking up, and I'm a perceptive person. I'm sure you could have seen me going, oh, really? because we've had some issues in the neighborhood. And so what I've come to understand is that there are people who are involved in things by virtue of having grown up here, who they know, you know, who their social circle is, whereby they're not safe if they're on their own. And so there is a safety in numbers, and there are longstanding feuds that are active.
And in this neighborhood?
In the neighborhood, yeah.
Wow.
And we, where I am in this building, happens to be like right in the middle. So, you know, we are sort of at the crossroads of this really longstanding feud that's going on between a number of groups that are here in the neighborhood. So you asked, you know, why, what are they missing, and is it connection and all that. It's really complicated.
Yeah, and I would love to go into a room and be able to talk to these young men and ask them and really try to understand what they're going through and what they need and what they want and what they're not getting.
Right.
Because for me to resort to that kind of violence,
mm-hmm.
I just wonder what leads a person to that. Do they think about the consequences?
That's what I was getting at, this whole thing about being on a bike. It means he doesn't care about the consequences.
Maybe he's not thinking about them. Maybe he thinks that it's really easy to get his target, and he's not thinking that he might have an accident and hit somebody unintended.
You know, I wonder whether it's – I don't know that it really matters. I wonder whether this is a casualty of war. You know, the whole thing about non-combatant, whatever. There's a euphemism in them. Not
like collateral damage?
Or? Well, it's more than just collateral damage. There's a term that's escaping my mind. They'll come to me at 2:00 this morning, or then the next morning. But the point being that, for example, the idea of going to jail, you know, the punishment, is not really compelling.
It's not a deterrent.
It's not a deterrent.
Not at all.
No. You know, and I'm saying this based on conversations that I've heard walking down the street. I remember one in particular that I found to be really disturbing. I overheard a few young men talking about somebody else who wasn't present and saying, oh, yeah, you know, he's he's weak because he's afraid to go to jail. And, you know, I was like, what is this now? Right of passage? But it's sort of like earning your stripes. And I hear conversations about people saying, well, the last time I was in jail, da 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 da, and then the time before that, da 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 da. So, you know, the idea of going to prison is not, and let me make a distinction between jail and prison. I'm talking about prison. The idea of going to prison is sort of a timeout, you know, if you will. It doesn't have that deterrent factor where, you know, if a person is bent on revenge and they carry out the act, okay, so the price of carrying out the act is that they end up in prison for a certain number of years or even the rest of their lives, but they achieved their goal.
Wow.
So these are the things that I hear in the neighborhood.
Wow.
You know?
so interesting. I would love to have conversations like that more.
Yeah. We'll work that out. Speaking of the conversations, Amy, we have come down to, you know, the end of expected time for the show. I so appreciate you coming on. I'm inspired by what I've heard about the work that you're doing. I might end up volunteering as well, because it is just so compelling and such a wonderful thing to be able to participate as a human being in helping people who have been subjected to these really horrible conditions find a place of resilience after trauma, you know, and grow into these more complex survivors. So I really appreciate
you
sharing that.
Thank you. I had a wonderful time.
Wonderful. And you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for listening, everyone. This has been Amy Rebecca Marcico, and I'm Batavila Mutombini, your host, wishing you a wonderful rest of the week, and hope that you come back for our next episode. Talk to you all later. Bye.